All right, I would like to embark on a very interesting voyage of discovery. But I want to do it in context. I had gotten, I think right now the ninth chapter is 90 pages long. I've gone back to the beginning of it and to add things that I thought were important to develop all the way through the chapter. So I'm at page 15 is where we're going to engage in the ninth chapter, which is not published anywhere, so there's no place to go read it, but we're still going to talk about it. And the way the chapter began is that since we had made the detour in chapter 8 to consider Zion and Zion's association with Dod David and Dod's relationship with Yahweh, I wanted to return to Yashayahu, because my goal and observations is once we establish a foundation, I want to get from Yashayahu 1 all the way through 14, because I know that by doing so, Yahweh is going to connect all of the dots for us. We're going to understand the connection between religion and Babylon, between the whore and Satan, as well as between Shaul, the wannabe apostle Paul, and Christianity. And I knew that God made that progression as he goes through Yashayah, Isaiah 1, all the way through 14. And so that was the goal. So as realizing that at this point we had already translated and considered all of chapter 1 and chapter 2, and recognizing all of chapter 1 and all of chapter 2 focus on a singular problem that God intended and had done everything in his power to raise his children, to nurture them, to lift them up, to care for them, and that his children rejected him for religion, and that the thing that had separated God and man was in fact religion. And he goes on to talk about the religion of his people and how the religion of his people was the very thing that caused him to declare in the opening verse of the third chapter that he was now withholding and withdrawing his provision to uphold life. And so I said, holy moly. Okay, this is powerful that God has explained that he intended to have a family, that man rejected him in favor of religion, and that as a result, God was now withholding his provision for life. And I said, you know, I don't think I'm going to get past verse 1 of chapter 3. In chapter 9, we need to stop everything and make absolutely certain we know what God's provision to uphold life is comprised of, because he's withdrawn it. And because he's withdrawn it, we need to understand, how do we get it back? I mean, there's very few things could be more important than that. And so what I noticed is that God began this statement with henna, which is just simply translated, we talked about that a moment ago, as behold. And as I was looking at henna, I said, you know, there's something really interesting about henna, something I'd never considered before, that henna is written with two hays, and a nun in the middle. Henna is family. Henna is a mother and a father standing up, looking up, and reaching up to God with a child in between them. Henna is the covenant. And I said, you know, there's two other words that come to mind that have two hays in them. As a matter of fact, while the Babylonian name for this letter that was depicted by a person standing up, reaching up, and looking up to God is now hay. That's the Babylonian version. Its original name was not hay. The original name for the letter is henna. And the letter means to look up, to pay attention. The letter is drawn exactly as it is defined. And I looked at that and said, what other two words have a pair of hays in them?
Easy.
Well, the first one is amongst the most important verbs in the Hebrew language. Hayah.
Hayah.
Hayah. When Yahweh introduced himself to Moshe, who, of course, was a seminary graduate, a profound theologian with doctoral degrees hanging on his wall. And, of course, knowing that no one could communicate God's word on his own, he immediately went to Moshe and said, you know what, you're not going to be doing this alone. We're going to form a committee. And so we're going to come up with a large committee, and you're all going to
have
curriculum and fancy plaques. And no, I didn't say that. Anyway, what he said is that I am who I am. I am who I am. Hayah. Asher. Hayah. I am who I am. And he said, tell the children of Israel, I exist. Hayah means I exist. It's the verb which defines Yahweh's name, because the next statement of Yahweh as well, tell them that Yahweh has sent you. Yahweh. Y-A-H. Hayah. H-Y-H. Yeah, Hayah not only tells you how to pronounce the first syllable of Yahweh's name, it tells you what the name means. And in that case, in the basis of the verb, which explains Yahweh's name, this time rather than henna, where you have two people standing up, a man and a woman with a child represented by the sperm in between them, in this case, in the basis for Yahweh's name, you have two people standing up, a man and a woman, a husband and wife. And in between them, Yahweh's hand reaching down and out to lift them up.
Yes.
Hayah is, in fact, also the covenant and the basis of Yahweh's name. So I looked at Yahweh's name. How many hays are there in Yahweh's name?
Have to be two.
Two of them, aren't there? So is it maybe this word, this word that so many people just, you know, toss away? I looked in Strong's because I wanted to know how many times it's used, and Strong's had this particular variation of it, the way it was pointed by the Masoretes, had 19. I said, no. Then I looked up, okay, well, they had like five other variations of it, and collectively the five other variations totaled like 50. No, not impossible. Well, there were 1,000 of them. And so I decided, well, you know, I'm going to go to the first use of henna, because something strikes me as, you know, sometimes you just get in your mind's eye that this is really important. Grab a hold of this and don't let go until you understand how important it is, because something in my gut, in my mind's eye told me that if you want to understand how we get God's provision to uphold life back, the explanation is in the first word of the first statement of the third chapter of Yeshayah, Isaiah, Hannah. So I've devoted this entire chapter to Yahweh's use of henna. And I was beginning to write about the discussion that Yahweh had with Noah. Because in the sixth chapter of Bereshit, Genesis, in the 13th verse, Yahweh uses henna to encourage Noah to pay attention, to consider what he has to say. Now, you know that it's funny because this fellow that wrote me said that, you know, you can't translate unless you consider the context, which, of course, he was crediting the religious scholars with doing in their translations, which, of course, they never do. And you know, if I was religious about something, what I'm religious about is context. You will never see me, ever, go to, for example, if henna appears in the 13th statement of the 6th chapter and the conversation begins at the first verse of the 6th chapter, I'm not going to the 13th verse to start. Even if it takes 2 weeks out of my life, I'm going to begin the conversation where the conversation began. So, I started with Bereshith 6:1, knowing that I was going to get to one of the very earliest uses of henna. And since I knew that now he was talking to Noah, I had a hunch this was going to be an important one. Because what Yahweh is saying is that rather than provision for life, I gave mortal man life as a gift. But he was on the verge of taking it away. And he was going to explain to Noah why he was taking away the gift that he had given to mortal man. And in addition to that, he was going to tell Noah precisely what instructions he needed to follow to keep his family safe and so that his family's lives could be upheld. So this was if there ever was going to be an answer to henna and to what is the provision for life and how do we get it back, then I was going to find it here. Now, what's interesting is that was not my first inclination, and we're going to start to 6:1 here in a moment. My first inclination was to go to henna's use in the discussions regarding the covenant, because every time Yahweh met with Abraham, somewhere in that conversation, he used henna. And so I figured that what we ought to do is just track henna through the covenant. And so I wrote most of this chapter is already written as we track henna through the covenant. I'm now dealing with the 7th meeting between Yahweh and Abraham. And as I was writing, it says, you know, before I finish this, I'm going to go back to the beginning, because the first mention of the covenant is not actually with Abraham. With Noah. And the first time that Yahweh gave instructions as to how to participate in the covenant wasn't with Abraham. It was with Noah. And while Yahweh asked Abraham to walk away from the land of Six, from the land of Babylon, from Sumer, where everything was based on Six, I mean, their entire way of reckoning time, of ordering space, of thinking, of their mathematical model was 60 days to counting. So I want you to walk away from that. But he, although identifying the country that he was in, which was Babel, the land of confusion, Yahweh doesn't explain what it is about them, the Babylonians, the Sumerians, that requires Abraham to leave them before he and Yahweh can have a discussion and engage in a relationship. But guess what? That's not the case with Noah. So there's a reason that Yahweh doesn't have to tell Abraham. He told Noah. And the story of Noah comes before the story of Abraham. So we ought to know what it was that he thought was so awful in man. And Kirk, what I came to find out is that what is awful in man is introduced to us in the word that Christian theologians have absolutely butchered. Have you ever heard of the Nephilim?
Mm-hmm.
The Nephilim, if you prefer. Ever heard of them?
Yes.
Yeah, how many times have you heard that they're giants?
Well, there's all the Christian Bibles say they're giants.
Yeah, they're all giants. Every Christian Bible says they're giants. All of them. I have a few now that for a very short period of time that, I mean, all of the early ones, first like 20, all were giants. All because of a mistake in the Septuagint that was copied into the Latin Vulgate that made its way into Wycliffe's first English translation that made it into all subsequent English translations, because the King James was a revision five times over of Wycliffe's translation of the Latin Vulgate. So it was, you know, garbage in, garbage out. There's not a single connotation associated with large or tall in the root of Nephilim. Not one. But what the word means is religious, bowing down and being cut down in war. And so I was studying this word that explained what all this was about. And as I was doing it, I said, since I've heard so many myths, I mean, I bet I've been asked 500 times, what can you tell me about the Nephilim? What do you think about them? It was obvious to me the first time I translated there. They were overtly religious and they were vicious. And then God said, you know, and there were people very similar to them that continued to populate the world thereafter. And they're well known. You've heard of their names. And that's what God said. And yet I realized that there wasn't an English Bible that communicated any of that.
They can't.
So I decided, why not figure out why they are all wrong, why they all say the same thing, and how they all came to the wrong definition. Fascinating. I mean, how could they all be wrong?
Well.
And so I've devoted 15 pages just to sharing not only why they are all wrong, but coming up to a profound conclusion. One that is so much more well-researched and stark than I ever thought possible in terms of what I think now is an undeniable realization regarding the totality of the Christian New Testament. So, if you'll bear with me, let's go through this. We will not get through it today. We're not going to finish it this evening, but we will finish it in time. This section begins, Henna is used again in Bereshith, Genesis 6:13, with Yahweh encouraging Noah to look up and pay attention, because the land had become so overwhelmed with cruelty and violence. For there to be any hope of a relationship, he would have to eliminate the perpetrators and start all over again, with the eight souls willing to respond to his life-saving instructions. Now, and that this story sheds light on the reason Yahweh was withholding his provision to sustain life in Yahshua, Isaiah 3:1, while also illustrating through Henna that God wanted Noah to understand his justifications for doing so. Let's review it from the beginning to its conclusion, wherein the covenant was established for the first time based upon Noah's willingness to do what Yahweh had instructed. So God's message begins. Indeed, when the defilement and slain, the profane nature, the contemptible attitude, and disgraceful wounding of the descendants of Adam came to exist on an ongoing basis. It increased dramatically, growing to the point of being multiplied greatly in a myriad of ways, reaching into the tens of thousands, with them shooting arrows at one another, within the area and before the presence of the descendants of Adam. Then daughters were born to them, and sons of the Almighty saw that the daughters of Adam indeed were desirable and valuable. So they grasped hold of and took them for themselves, women from any which they, as a result of their relationships and to benefit their ways, chose. Then Yahweh said, "My spirit shall not remain or abide with the descendants of Adam forever. because indeed, in addition to this, he is flesh and prone to proclaiming, publishing, and preaching news, which is considered good and beneficial by those who hear it. So for a period of time, it shall come to be that his days will be 120 years. There were, for a limited period of time, the Nephilim, those who prostrate themselves and are stillborn, falling in prayer, battle, and status, who are militaristic and thus meet an untimely death, existing in the region in those days, but also those bearing a resemblance to them in a slightly different form for some time thereafter. By association, the sons of the Almighty came to, making a habit of pursuing the daughters of man, the female descendants of Adam, and they conceived children for themselves. These warriors and political leaders, prominent individuals with an ability to fight who prevailed in their quest for military and political power, who were from a relatively long time ago, are individuals with reputations and with recognizable names. Now that's Barashith 1, or 6, 1 through 4. I dare say that is nothing like what you have ever read in an English Bible.
No.
And the purpose now is not to analyze every word of that, with one exception. I want to spend a little time on 6:4. Because we'll go back to this as we finish chapter 6, 7, and 8, and eventually in 9. We'll go through this material word for word. Okay. But let's spend a moment on Genesis, Bereshith 6:4. There were Haya for a limited period of time. There actually and literally existed, call imperfect, the Nephilim, N-E-P-H-Y-L-Y-M. What does the Y-M at the end of it mean, Kirk?
Plural.
Plural. What is the Ha before Nephilim mean?
The.
So, is the Nephilim being used here as a common word to be translated, or as a title or name?
Well, it's
Ha Nephilim.
Yeah.
This is like saying there were the Americans, there were the Russians,
yeah,
there were the Romans,
yeah,
there were the Babylonians, and there were the Nephilim. You cannot translate a word, Ha Nephilim, as there were giants.
No.
This is a definite article here. So it's the Nephilim. Now, when Yahweh is using a title, is it appropriate to transliterate that title, which it means to convey the pronunciation of the title in the language that you're translating it into?
Well, names you transliterate, the others are translated.
You always have to transliterate a name. Titles?
Translate?
Titles, the answer to titles is that by far the most accurate way to handle a title,
mm-hmm,
is the way we handle Mikre. Mikre is the title that Yahweh uses to describe his seven invitations to be called out and to meet. The definition or translation of Mikre is invitations to be called out and meet. So the best way to handle a title like Mikre is to transliterate it so that the title is conveyed, you know what he's talking about, and then to provide a translation of it so that you understand what the title means.
Yes. Well, that's
okay.
What we do, isn't it? Yeah.
That is the way you handle a title. Ha Nephilim is a title. Transliterate it. There were the Nephilim, those who prostrate themselves and are stillborn, from the verbal root, Nephal. All YM means is it's plural. So the verbal root for Nephil is Nephal. But you know, you don't have to go very far to find the verbal root of Nephil as Nephal. Nephal means to fall in prayer, battle, and status. going from a higher position to a lower one. Those who were separated and die. Those who bow down, falling prostrate, to worship something on the ground.
I mean, look what he's calling you.
Those who neglect and therefore are neglected. Those who attack to conquer in an offensive military action, becoming inferior in the process. Those subject to miscarriage and thus untimely death. Okay, I just went through the definition of the fall. Did you hear any word in there that screamed out to you, really big giants?
No.
In fact, it was the opposite, wasn't it?
Yeah, it would be, in context of everything we've covered so far, it would be a radical departure from what you all said a hundred times already. So,
yeah. There is nothing with Nephal that speaks of big. Everything associated with Nephal speaks of diminished, bowing down, prostrating oneself, being diminished, suffering a miscarriage, having one's life shortened. You know, that's really important because, you know, all the English Bibles translated that there were giants in the land. Is man taller today, or was he taller 5,000 years ago?
Well, he's much taller today.
Much taller, almost a foot taller.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any paleontologist or archaeologist who has found a race of giants, the bones of a race of giants? Any?
No.
Ever?
Not to my knowledge.
No. Has there ever been a race of giants on the earth?
No.
No. So if Yahweh said that there were giants in the land, and we have absolute, unequivocal proof that man is taller today than he was then, and that while there might have been the occasional exceedingly tall person.
Well, that's a pituitary gland. That's not,
yeah, that's
not
right.
A race of people.
Since we know for certain there was no race of people ever that could be considered giants, when these nincompoops translate this word that speaks of being diminished as a result of religion and militancy, cutting people down, as giants, aren't they making God out to be a liar?
Well, sure, but they can't, because if you're King James him, you're not going to knock religion.
Yes, that's right. So they're they have God come across as an ignorant nincompoop by saying that there were giants in the land. You know, I read one of the I have a lot to say on this subject, and so I wanted to look up and say, how in the hell does somebody justify the King James, which is the sixth in the list of English translations using giants, and it's the eighth overall, because the Septuagint is where the mistake occurred, and then it was copied by Jerome in the Latin Vulgate, and then Wycliffe translated the Vulgate, so he came up with giants, and no one's been able to get off the error train. And so they all have giants. And this person was trying to justify the giants. He says, proof that it's giants is that the five Bible translations before the King James all had giants. The Vulgate has giants. The Septuagint has giants.
Therefore,
it's giants. He says, who in the hell knows what a Nephilim is? A Nephilim. But we sure in the hell know what giants are. And this idiot, idiot wasn't smart enough to say, but there never has been a race of giants. Yeah, we know what giants are, and there never has been a race of giants. So if God said that, your God is a nincompoop. All right. So that's it. So there were, for a period of time, Nephilim existing in the region. Haya, Ba, Ha, Eretz. God is speaking about the descendants of Adam. He's using Ha-Adam here. He's not using Ish individuals.
No.
He is not using Hanak, mortal man.
No, because then it could be a race.
Yeah.
Using Adam.
Right. He's not using mortals. He's using Ha-Adam, the descendants of Adam. They lived in this region. We'll talk to you this evening.